Welcome to the Space Show. What's your role in the European Space Agency?
Well, my role in the European Space Agency is to look at the advanced manufacturing processes and the advanced materials that may be used within the next, let's say, 5 to 20 or 50 years for space activities. So I'm looking really at the near and very far future.
Does the European Space Agency make its own satellites, or do you just buy them in?
What we do is we have bids for scientific satellites or for any kind of satellite. Okay, we issue bids. We receive answer to bids, and then we judge what is the best one, and we award a contract to the best bidder.
How many satellites does the European Space Agency launch every year, approximately?
Approximately, it's very difficult to say. It is few satellites, but we have, I would say, in the range of one satellite for science, because it's always very complex missions. Perhaps one or two satellites for Earth observation, and it depends also on the size of the satellite. I mean, we have satellites that are extremely big and complex with many instruments, some others with less instruments, but I cannot give you a figure like that. It's just a few satellites. We have, five launch per year with Ariane 5. We will have a few launch per year with Vega, the new launcher. And we'll launch many satellites also for Galileo with Soyuz. Less than 20 for sure, but how many, I don't know.
And what challenges do you face in building these satellites?
We face plenty of challenges all the time. We face challenges with respect to the manufacturing, the control, the design, the obsolescence. Very often we deal with obsolescence because we have to freeze the design at a point in time. And at the day we freeze the design, we have very, very advanced technologies that are obsolete when we launch the satellite, or that are not as advanced, let's say. It's one of, but complexity of the system is probably one of the main difficulties when we are making satellites.
And are there problems in materials that you make the satellites from?
With respect to materials, we have to deal with heritage, because we want to have solutions that are flight proven. And flight proven means that we are using very, very old materials because we are sure that they will work. And we have this reliability issue that is extremely important. So we, at the same time, when it is needed, we can go to totally new material, things that have never been used before. During my presentation, I shown a picture of the Herschel telescope. That is a 3.5-meter telescope made of pure silicon carbide ceramic material that nobody else has except Europe, and it was designed, all the process was made specifically for this satellite initially. So we have sometimes extremely advanced materials.
Now, what stresses or risks do satellites face during their launch? What risks do satellites face during their launch? There's a particular environment. There's a lot of shaking and vibration.
Yeah, well, mainly all, it has to resist the launch. It's just vibration, acoustic vibration, mechanical vibration, and this is it. If it survives the launch, normally we are more or less relaxed for the duration of the mission. But this is the time where, in fact, we shake everything and where we need really to have the structural requirements.
And once a satellite gets into space, it's not just empty space, it's a particular environment. There are hazards there as well, aren't there?
Yeah, but okay, with respect to space, what we have is we have only one force that remains when we are in space. It is inertia. Okay? Whenever we move something, we have to stop it. So this is the own energy that was generated during the movement that has to be stopped. But for the rest, it is mainly thermocycling. Thermocycling is very, very difficult. It has to deal also with aging and loss of some of the characteristics of the material, changing some of the plastic behavior or polymer behavior, let's say. They can become brittle, they can become less efficient. Thermocontrol systems also. Thermocontrol coatings can also change properties with aging. So we have a lot of things like that, yes.
Now, satellites have complex parts, for example, antennae or thrusters. What innovative technologies are being developed to make these now?
This is something I cannot answer. I cannot answer because my knowledge is extremely limited compared to the extremely broad range of technologies that are used. I can give you some hints. I know, for instance, that for propulsion, we have electric propulsion that is under development that has been already used, but we have also chemical propulsion that is still very active, and it will not just fade away. We will have a lot of change in regulation, so we'll also go into green propellant, into green technologies for propulsion. So with respect to propulsion, we have really a lot of things that need to be changed or modified or improved. But to give you this kind of thing, I'm totally unable to give a correct answer.
What is additive manufacturing?
Okay, additive manufacturing. So additive manufacturing is a different way of building stuff. During the last century, we have based all our building on machine tools, meaning that we start from a very big block, and with this very big block, we remove all the material that is not needed to get at the end a part that is functional. With additive manufacturing, what we do is we say we will deposit material only where it is needed. So we make the design, and we will build the part normally layer per layer. So you just slide your design from the bottom to the top, and then you will put the slide one on top of the other. And so you put a thin layer of powder, for instance, and then you will solidify this powder using a laser on an electron beam or any kind of other source. It can be also an adhesive, a glue or something like that. And then you build your part like that.
So you're moving away from milling away the metal, cutting away the metal, towards just building it up from zero.
Yes and no. I would not say that it is not the holy grail. It is not something that will replace all the other techniques. Mm-hmm. It is something that needs to be considered and that has a very high potential for us. Okay, but it is not. We will try in the future to have the best solution, and the best solution may be additive manufacturing.
So what are the advantages of additive manufacturing?
It really depends on the part that you can get. If you go for people who are selling the additive manufacturing technology, they will say it is quicker. It's not always true. It is cheaper. It is not always true. It gives designing freedom. It is true, and at the same time, it is not true because we have other limits. It provides very interesting metallurgical properties. This is true, but we have at the same time some defects that are generated that we do not control. So it is a different way of manufacturing with a very high potential, but we have to transform this potential into something that is really real.
Can you make parts that can't be milled or cast?
Yes. Anything that has internal porosity, internal complexity, just imagine that you want to make internal channels that would be extremely complex. They cannot be milled or they cannot be milled or cast. But with additive, you can make very, very complex channels.
Where do you see additive manufacturing going in the European Space Agency?
Well, we see it, I would say, in all directions. It could be used from the ground support equipment up to colonization of a planet. So it can go from very small up to several tons. It is all the different materials, it is all the different applications. What we need to do is to understand where it can bring a benefit, so when it shall be used.
And do you have a program for making sure that industries outside of the space industry start using your techniques?
I think I don't need to have a program on that. I think that all industry has realized that there is a potential. But the rationale for developing additive manufacturing by the different industries is very different. For us, it is very often linked to the fact that we have very small series, few items the same, or we have to change the design slightly between item A and item B. So for us, it is really, it could really help in reducing the lead time, reducing the cost for testing, reducing the cost for integration. So it's something that we are looking at, I would say, on a very global perspective.
Now, in your talk, you mentioned the building of lunar bases. What's the idea there?
Well, the idea is, this one is a study that is extremely interesting because it is a study that is coming that has been funded by the General Study Program, and the General Study Program at the agency is addressing points where we don't have any clue, or when we want to make the first step. And this step was, is it stupid to build something on the moon to shelter the astronauts from the harsh environment if one day we go on the moon? Or is it better just to send something that would be fully furnished and that would shelter the astronaut directly from Earth? And when we started the study, we had no idea. So when we finished the study, we said, it is not stupid. It doesn't mean that it is the right solution, but it means simply it is feasible to do like that. Now we have to look at system studies, we have to look at what is the power requirement, we need to find out what is the time requirement to make this kind of structures, how can we control the quality, how do we put it into a global moon-based establishment.
So effectively you're talking about, instead of making a moon base or the parts to a moon base here on Earth and then taking them to the moon, you're taking the machinery to build it to the moon and then using the machine and the materials on the moon.
Yes, exactly. When we go to the moon, each kilogram is even more expensive than when we go in low Earth orbit or in geostationary orbit. So we have to save any gram we can, unless we find something with respect to propulsion that makes the launch cheap. But we are not here today. So if we can use the in-situ resources, everything that is available on the spot, and reduce the amount of material and the amount of hardware that we bring from Earth, it could save a tremendous amount of money.
And are the materials suitable? You know, the lunar material, the regolith as it's called, is that material suitable for manufacturing materials?
Well, this is a question mark that is still open. If I remember well, we have some kilograms of materials that were brought by the different Apollo missions. And this material do not have exactly the same composition or the same aspect, depending on the place where they were collected. So what we have done, we looked at the lunar regolith sealant that is sold by NASA, and we said we'll try to mimic it, to reproduce it up to the best we can. And this is what we have done. So we have a comparison. It's more than 95 or 98% similar to the one that is sold by NASA. Is it the one that we'll find when we land at the place where we decide to build the base? I cannot answer.
Have any tests been done?
Yeah, well, we have done tests. First, we have demonstrated that the process works. Okay, the process works with something that would be the regolith simulant and liquid ink, a binding ink that is used by transforming the sand into a solid stone, let's say. And second, we have also checked that the process can work under vacuum, because normally when you have liquid under vacuum, it just boils off. In this case, what we have done is we have injected the liquid under the surface into a vacuum chamber, and we have left the reaction taking place. And 2 days after starting the reaction, we had solid that were formed, meaning that In fact, the capillary forces that are inside the powder has enough to keep the liquid and to have the reaction taking place. This is what we have done until now, and of course we have made mechanical characterization of the material, but built with in atmosphere, to be able to make the design of the base.
Oh, thank you for joining us on the space show.
Yeah, you're very welcome.